Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Sometimes childhood interests have unexpected consequences. Take a kid who grows up on Montana ranches. Things are pretty much what you'd expect, except his fascination with birds. Among other things, they can fly. And he decides that he would like to fly, too. And that leads to an interesting story. Dan Ellison is about to tell us about it. Dan, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be here.
I said you grew up on a Montana ranch. Why don't you tell us about that?
My family moved to Montana when I was a year old from Iowa. And we lived in Three Forks and Spring Hill and Stevensville and Florence and Stevensville again, always in the country on cattle ranches primarily.
Now, was your dad a ranch hand, or what was the deal?
He was a hired man at first, and Then pretty soon he and Mom bought a few cows, and then pretty soon they bought a few acres, And then they bought a ranch.
And their ranch was?
It's a mile outside of Stevensville, and Mom, who turns 91 in a month, is still living there.
So you were basically a ranch kid from 1 year old till when?
Till I left the ranch when I was 18 years old.
At the end of high school?
At the end of high school.
Okay, let's talk about that period of time. We tend to take for granted what we grow up in as a normal life because it's ours. How was ranch life for you, the good and the bad?
Ranch life was just what we knew. It was 7 days a week working. I was a very ordinary child. Nothing really special about me. I didn't get great grades. I wasn't a good athlete. But I was in 4-H, junior achievement, played the piano, those kind of things.
Played the piano. Who taught you how to play and why did you play?
Mrs. Robinson taught me how in Stevensville. And my mom wanted all of us to play a musical instrument, and so I did that, and I got pretty good with the piano. Won a county competition when I was in 8th grade.
When you say all of us, that means there's more than one kid in the family?
Older brother and three younger sisters. And so we had a large family. And I went to high school in Missoula, and in my senior year received an alternate appointment from Senator Metcalf to go to the Naval Academy.
Okay, you're getting ahead of me. I'm still back on the ranch.
Okay.
So looking back on that life before you went to high school, what was it like, the good and the bad?
Well, the good was you learn lessons for life growing up in a ranching environment. And one of those is when you have cattle and horses and sheep and other livestock, they don't take a day off. They don't take Christmas off or Thanksgiving or New Year's. They've got to be fed and watered. And so when the kids have responsibility to do that, you learn pretty early on in life that those things have to happen, and there's consequences if they don't happen. I would put that as one of the good things about growing up. We worked 7 days a week. I mean, there were chores to do every day of the week, and somebody had to do those chores. My dad had a very strong work ethic, as did my mother, and she kind of organized things in the house, and Dad kind of organized things outside. And when the kids were old enough to work outside, we all did that. And that was part of what made the ranch life successful.
In terms of friends, were they ranch friends or town friends or both? Talking elementary school?
Mostly they would be ranch friends, kids that I would know through 4-H. County fair, you know, showed cattle and sheep and sometimes pigs every year at the county fair in Hamilton. And all of my sisters and my brother did that. And we'd participate in the Creamery Picnic every year in Stevensville. You know, it was a great event then, you know, parade and all kinds of activities. But most of our contacts were with other ranching, farming families.
My experience is ranchers tend to pride themselves on a sense of independence, and yet there is a ranching community that is of importance. What would you say in terms of your growing up, where you end up when you leave the ranch, what would you have said if somebody said to you, are you an independent kid, or are you part of a community, or what? It might be a strange question to ask an 18-year-old, but how does that look to you, looking back?
I wouldn't have known what it meant to be part of a community. The closest we ever lived to town was a mile away, And when we lived at Florence, the nearest neighbor was a half a mile away.
Okay.
We were out in the country. And so community wasn't a concept that I was all that familiar with. And when I went away to high school, that was Missoula. To me, that was a huge place. I mean, there were thousands of people there. And, you know, there were 800 kids in my high school class. And this was so different than anything I'd ever experienced.
Okay, so you go to Missoula and suddenly you're in this huge facility. What's it like for a kid who does not have a sense of community?
I was pretty much lost. I just didn't know, I didn't have friends. And most of the kids in my class had gone to school with each other or gone to adjacent schools, and they knew each other. They'd played sports against each other. They'd, mm-hmm. Been in all kinds of different activities, you know, whether it was band or who knows what else. And I hadn't done those things, so I was pretty much an outsider. And living 30 miles away and driving in every day with my brother, you know, we didn't have after school really activities other than athletics to participate in. And of course, we needed to do our work on the ranch. We always had chores in the morning and evening, even on school days.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Dan Ellison. Before we leave the ranch life behind, when you're on a ranch, you're around wild animals and wild creatures. Was that important to you growing up?
That was one of the best parts of growing up, is that we had wildlife on the ranch and near the ranch, and of course we were close to the Bitterroot River. Good fishing, good hunting, lots of waterfowl, lots of other kinds of birds, and plenty of different kinds of mammals around. And I was just very much drawn to wildlife.
Any thoughts as to why? You remember anything about that attraction?
The birds attracted me simply because of what they could do. And, you know, we'd put up hummingbird feeders, and I couldn't believe the way hummingbirds could fly. They come out of the nest, and they can hover, they can back up, they can go fast, they can dive and climb. They can do amazing things. And I was just always taken by what birds could do and what you would see them do. And that's stayed with me right up to today.
Just a footnote, I have friends who have a ranch in the mountains in Arizona along the Mexican border, and they banned hummingbirds. And those hummingbirds migrate through here along the east front up to Canada. Yeah. Blows my mind given the size of those birds.
And my interest in birds, you know, it caused me to be interested in flying. I wanted to learn how to fly.
And my dad, that's very interesting to me.
My dad encouraged me in that regard. He had been a B-24 pilot in World War II, and he suggested in his quiet way that flying was a good thing to do if you were good enough to learn how to do it. Mom took a little different approach. She said, find something that you like doing and be better at it than anybody else. That was a little more of a challenge than I was ready to undertake right then. But those two inputs from my parents kind of propelled me toward wanting to be a pilot. And at that time, I thought about the only way to do that is to be a military pilot.
We're talking which years?
I was a junior in high school when I applied to go to the Air Force Academy and the Naval Academy.
And that, what year was that?
That would have been 1965.
Okay, the beginning of the escalation of the war in Vietnam.
Yes, it was ramping up in a big way then.
So what happens?
So I applied to Senator Metcalf, Senator Mansfield, and Representative Olson, and eventually I got an alternate appointment from Senator Metcalf to the Naval Academy. I was third alternate. And then one of the guys ahead of me dropped out, and I was second alternate.
But obviously you end up getting in there, or we wouldn't be telling the story.
I did get in there because they picked about 150, the Naval Academy picked about 150 alternates to fill out the class. We had about 1,440 that entered the class in 1966 in June, and 4 years later there were about 820 of us left.
Pretty high attrition rate.
Well, consider the time, Brian. I mean, Vietnam was getting really, really ugly at the time that I was at the Naval Academy, the Tet Offensive in 1968, those kind of things. And We had members of my class that simply chose not to want to be in the military then. And we also had a very rigorous training and academic cycle that we were involved with on a daily basis. Take about 21 or 22 credit hours, not counting our military training.
That's pretty intense.
Extremely intense. And in an engineering discipline. And I did not have good grades there. I finished in the top 60% of my class academically, but I was in the top 10 in demerits when I graduated.
Demerits?
Demerits. I was within a whisker of having more demerits than were allowed to graduate.
Just generally speaking, the statute of limitations has long passed.
Unfortunately.
But what constitutes a demerit in the military academy?
It could be virtually anything.
Well,
not having your room clean enough.
That's what I wondered.
Being slightly late to a formation. Not knowing the knowledge that you would be required to know. Just any number of small infractions.
You pointed out part of the attrition was some students' response to the Vietnam War. What was yours? What was your perception during your time in the Naval Academy about the war? What was at stake? Good idea, bad idea? What did you think about it?
That's a really valid question, one that, you know, I didn't think about it a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, national policy was just beyond really my scope of reference as a 19, 20, 21-year-old. I was worried every day about my grades and getting through the Naval Academy. Mm. But for me, the fact that our nation was engaged in a war and I was wearing the country's uniform meant that sooner or later I was probably going to be involved in that.
Right.
And had I been uncomfortable to the point that I thought that was a bad idea, then I'd have had to have made a different life decision. But the policymakers had determined that this was the policy that we were pursuing, and as far as I was concerned, I was going to do my duty.
Now we're 40-plus years down the road. The war ended 40 years ago. You've had time to think about it. What's your sense for the war in Vietnam? Was a major factor in your youth for the whole country?
When I look back on it now, it's pretty easy for me to look back and say that was a terrible waste of lives and treasure to do that. And, you know, there were about four different administrations from Eisenhower through Kennedy and Johnson to Nixon that were engaged at some level in that conflict. And it just seems to me like there could have been a better path. I wish that our country and the country of Vietnam and the other nations that were involved had not had to go through that experience.
So what do you do now? You're in college. You got the fork in the road at the Naval Academy. You came in part because you're interested in flying. Mm-hmm. What happens?
My goal was always to be a pilot. From the day I entered onward, I wanted to be a Navy pilot. And in senior year, about halfway through senior year, service selection is made, and the primary operational areas are aviation, surface ships, and submarines. And so when it came my turn, and you do that by class standing to go down and make a selection, I wrote in aviation and picked an early date to go and start flight school, which would be in Pensacola, Florida, and I was selected to do that.
All right.
And so now I knew that I was going to be on the track to become a Navy pilot.
All right, now you move forward and you at some point start flying airplanes, correct?
I did.
Training.
Okay,
anything. How was it for you? Because I think perhaps you had an unusually early interest in flying. How was it as a real experience in terms of you had high expectations, whatever? There was something in this for you personally in terms of meaning. Was it what you expected or not?
It was better than I expected. It was everything I could have hoped for. Get up in the morning, put on my flight suit, go down pre-flight in aircraft and go flying and get paid to do it. I thought this is absolutely what I was meant to do. And once again, the attrition rate in flight school was fairly high. Some guys just couldn't fly. Others had trouble in the classroom with the academics. Some could fly you know, primary, and then you get to basic and start doing instruments, and they were completely befuddled by that. And for me, the fly-in was just unbelievably good. And it turned out I was good at it. I don't know why I was good at it, but I was. And I loved doing it. And so I had really good flight grades. The aircraft that I really wanted to fly, the F-8 Crusader, first tour aviators didn't get to do that, so I chose to go in helicopters, and I thought maybe fly search and rescue.
Maybe it reminded you of the hummingbird.
Might have done that. I love the hummingbirds, and I thought, you know, hovering and backing up is pretty neat, you know, if you could do that.
So you start flying helicopters when?
That's in advanced training. You have three phases of training, primary, basic, and by basic you've got about 130 hours, and then advanced, you go to kind of fly the type of aircraft that you're going to fly in the fleet.
You start flying what year?
I started flying in 1970, in July of 1970, and I got my wings in September of 1971 and immediately got orders to a combat search and rescue squadron in San Diego.
So how long are you involved in the search and rescue flying assignment?
Well, that was one tour of duty, about 3 years, and then I transitioned from that to go be a flight instructor in Pensacola. Transitioned from that to a squadron that provided support to the National Science Foundation in Antarctica.
Huh.
And did three deployments to Antarctica, met my wife there. And then I transitioned from that to a shore duty assignment, search and rescue in Central California. And then out to the fleet again in Hawaii, and then back to the War College in 1985.
So you've had 15 years of active duty, then what?
I came back from a Western Pacific deployment and received orders to the Naval War College. And that was a year in Newport, Rhode Island, studying strategy and policy, joint operations, various components of the national defense strategy.
Okay, that's a big shift. In other words, and now we're just talking academics, but we're talking instead of flying helicopters and technical, what I'll call technical things of significance, we're now talking policy at a major level.
That's right.
How did you find that as an experience, as a transition?
I thought it was a great time in my life.
Why?
And I'd gone from a focus on operations, and now I was, as Admiral Service said the day we arrived at the War College, we're going to broaden your focus way out here. You've been focused very narrowly on your type aircraft or your ship, and now we're going to give you the national policy and strategy implications of what you do out there every day, you know, in uniform, protecting the security interests of the United States.
Okay, and the purpose of the War College, in terms of its graduates, its functional existence, is what? Why is it there?
To educate senior officers in national defense and policy making, so that when they go on to positions of greater responsibility, they will have a good understanding of the various components that go into making up national policy.
So this is a fundamental shift. How did you do at it?
Much to my surprise, I was a pretty good student at the War College. I liked the strategy and policy course. I mean, we read books from Thucydides and Polybius all the way up through Clausewitz and Mahan, wrote papers. Then we went on to joint operations, and I got a good appreciation for how the nation wanted the services to start doing a better job of working together in an operational setting. And then I was chosen for an advanced research project, and so I designed a study about the defense of Alaska and, a lot of natural resources and a long way away and a very important part of our country and, you know, very close to the Russian border.
So let me just jump in here. That is an example of the combination or confluence of national economic and strategic and military interests. Fair?
Yes, that's a great summary of it, Brian.
Okay.
That's exactly what we were studying.
All right, so you're studying that for the future service of your country to help decision makers and potentially become one who's making decisions that involve those very significant strategic and national interests. Fair?
That's fair.
When do you get to put your knowledge to use?
I graduated in November of 1985 and received orders to the U.S. Space Command. And much to my surprise again, I'm assigned as a speechwriter for the Commander-in-Chief, a four-star Air Force general. A great tour of duty and another new challenge for me, which eventually led to an assignment back at the Pentagon as a speechwriter for the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And a year after that, I was selected to be a legislative assistant for the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who at that time was General Colin Powell.
Who later became Secretary of State.
He did, after he retired from active duty.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Dan Ellison. Let me just summarize in terms of time here. Having looked at your biography, during this period, you're writing speeches and preparing legislative testimony for military and civilian officials at a high level. Is that a fair summary?
That is a fair summary. I'd say at the highest level of our government.
Okay. Did you feel prepared for it? You've come out of the war college. You've had the experiences you've had. Were you prepared for it?
I was partially prepared for it. I'd had a speech writing for a four-star general in Colorado,
okay.
And that really helped me with, you know, what we do from space, surveillance, communications, navigation, those kind of things. And now I was covering a broader spectrum, the $300 billion annual military budget, various arms control treaties that were working their way through the negotiating process and getting to the point where they might come before the Senate for confirmation.
So to write a speech on an arms treaty, just to pick that, seems to me you have to familiarize yourself with high-level policy both from the civilian and military perspective. Fair?
That's fair, and work with people from the State Department and the various military branches and various other agencies of the U.S. government and read the treaty front to back and be intimately familiar with the details that are in it so that the principal who's going to be giving testimony or giving a speech to some organization has the facts delivered in a very cogent manner.
Now, we've interviewed on our show people who worked for United States senators that level on the civilian side in an analogous capacity. But I've never interviewed anybody, and this is our 20th year on the air, who's worked that combination, primarily military, but interfacing with the highest levels of civilian authority over the military. So I want to explore it because I think it's an area that the public, including myself, is not generally exposed to, that level of high staff work. Very broadly put, as a citizen, I look at those systems and I see a combination of professionalism and politics. And I'm going to just generally define professionalism as rational, thoughtful analysis with some blend of national interest as defined by the institution driving it. And I'm going to define politics just for the moment pejoratively as sort of what's in it for my district or my state, just roughly put, although I'm not criticizing our democratic system, but it tends to work that way in some respects. What was your experience on those two, the blend of those two in various settings?
Brian, you ask about the professionalism of the people that I worked with, mm-hmm. and it was at absolutely the highest level that I'd ever experienced. I mean, really highly qualified, motivated people, and we worked in an extremely dynamic environment. The period of time I worked for General Powell, we had the Berlin Wall came down, a coup in the Soviet Union, the Gulf War, and then we downsized the military by about 500,000 people in a few years' time. It was a constant dynamic environment, all kinds of challenges coming up, and the professionalism of the people I don't think could have been any higher. But I would say pretty much the same about the civilian members that I encountered too, from appointed cabinet secretaries and deputy secretaries on down through their staffs that I worked with.
Now let me just jump in. Cabinet secretaries, this would be like the Secretary of Defense's establishment that would interface with you.
That's right. And often I would accompany one of the members of the Secretary of Defense's staff to his office. That was Secretary Cheney at that time, mm-hmm. In coordinating testimony that the Secretary and General Powell were going to give on a certain issue to one of the Armed Services Committees or one of the Intelligence Committees.
Critical question in terms of our system of government. We have civilian supervision of the military. You're interfacing at the highest levels of civilian oversight and command. Military people have a career of training before they get to where you are. What was the level of knowledge of the people that you dealt with on the civilian side? What was the range of it? Or were they all expert in the field that you were interfacing with?
I wouldn't say they were all expert. Some were extremely knowledgeable. And I experienced that in some of the arms control treaties that I helped work. And some of the people that I dealt with at State Department and other agencies on arms control had spent their entire careers in that field, and they had encyclopedic knowledge of the subject that we were taking on. Others did not have that. Some of the civilians that I interacted with were political appointees, and so they were more generalists, mm-hmm. and the good ones would rely on those with particular expertise in a certain system or part of the budget, and others sometimes would not.
Charts in textbooks are one thing, reality is another. You're working at the highest level of interface of civilian and military authority on a major national policy. Looking back as a citizen, how do you rate its pluses and minuses?
There were both pluses and minuses. Let me talk about a minus. One of the things that we worked on in the defense budget all the years that I was at the Pentagon was request for the V-22 Osprey for the Marine Corps, which was never part of the Navy Department's request in their budget. But in certain congressional districts, there was a great deal of interest in building that aircraft. And so there was conflict there. There was a lot of conflict about that.
And it was built.
Eventually, it was built. But on the strength side, the Desert Storm, the first Gulf War, you know, the president and with his advisors crafted a policy to say the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait is not going to stand. We're going to form a coalition. We're going to evict the Iraqis out of Kuwait. And then he turned to the experts, the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and said, you guys figure out a plan to make this happen. And it's not that the White House stayed out of it, but they let the experts do their work. And for having to go to war, which is always a last option for policy in our country, that one went pretty well.
Let me end with a personal question. You worked for Colin Powell, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, later Secretary of State. What was your impression of him as a man?
Greatest officer that I ever encountered. Leader, mentor, just an absolute wonderful officer.
Dan Ellison, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.